sliver of ocean, and then he could see nothing. Real life was back again. A new work detail had been assigned, and Jundo had no illusions about what kind of business it might entail. He turned to the men in suits. They were talking about a co-worker who was sick. They speculated on whether or not the sick man had a stockpile of food, and who would get his apartment if he died. The Mercedes had windshield wiper blades, something you never saw, and the radio was factory, capable of picking up broadcasts from South Korea and Voice of America. Breaking that law alone could get you sent to a mining camp, unless you happened to be above the law. While the men spoke, Jundo observed that their teeth had been fixed with gold, something possible only in Pyongyang. Yes, the hero thought. This might be his ugliest assignment yet. The two men drove Jundo inland to a deserted airbase. Some of the hangars had been converted into hothouses, and in the meadows surrounding the runway, Jundo could see broken-down cargo planes had been pushed off the blacktop. They lay this way and that in the grass, their fuselages now serving as ostrich warrens. The birds' small heads watched him pass through clouded cockpit windows. They came to a small airliner, engines running. Descending its steps came two men in blue suits. One was older and quite small, like a grandfather wearing the dress clothes of his grandson. The old man took a look at Jundo, then turned to the man next to him.
"Where's his suit?" the old man asked. "Comrade Byuk, I told you he must have a suit."
Comrade Byuk was young and lean, with round glasses. His Kim Il-sung pin was perfectly placed. But he had a deep vertical scar above his right eye. It had mishealed so that his eyebrow was broken into two pieces that didn't quite line up.
"You heard Dr. Song," he told the drivers. "The man must have a suit."
Comrade Byuk ushered the smaller driver to Jundo, where he compared their shoulders. Then he had the taller driver stand back to back with Jundo. When Jundo felt the other man's shoulder blades, it began to really sink in, that he probably wouldn't be upon the sea again, that he'd never know what would become of the second mate's wife, beyond the image of the hem of her yellow dress being fingered by an old warden from Shinpo. He thought of all the broadcasts he'd miss, of lives continuing beyond him. His whole life, he'd been assigned to work details without warning or explanation. There'd never been any point in asking questions or speculating on why. It never changed the work that had to be done. But then again, he'd never had anything to lose before. To the taller driver, Dr. Song said,
"Come, come, off with it."
The driver began to shed the jacket.
"This suit's from Shenyang," he complained.
Comrade Byuk was having none of it.
"You got that in Hamhung, and you know it."
The driver loosened the shirt buttons and then the cuffs, and when he had it off, Jundo offered in return the second mate's work shirt.
"I don't want your lousy shirt," the driver said.
Before Jundo could don the new shirt, Dr. Song said,
"Not so fast. Let's have a look at that shark bite of yours."
Dr. Song lowered his glasses and leaned in close. He touched the wound very delicately and rotated Jundo's arm to examine the stitches. In the sunlight, Jundo could see the redness around the sutures, the way the seams wept.
"Very convincing," Dr. Song said.
"Convincing?" Jundo asked.
"I nearly died from that." "The timing is perfect," Comrade Byuk said. "Those stitches will have to come out soon. Will you have one of their doctors do it, or would it speak louder if we pulled them ourselves?"
"What kind of a doctor are you?" Jundo asked. Dr. Song didn't answer. His watery eyes were fixed on the tattoo on Jundo's chest.
"I see our hero is a patron of the cinema,"
Dr. Song said. With a finger, he rapped Jundo on the arm as a sign to get dressed, then asked him,
"Did you know Sun Moon is Comrade Byuk's girlfriend?"
Comrade Byuk smiled, indulging the old man.
"She's my neighbor," he corrected.
"In Pyongyang?" Jundo asked. Immediately he knew the question marked him as a rube. To cover his ignorance, he said,
"Then you know her husband, Commander Ga?"
Dr. Song and Comrade Byuk went silent. Jundo went on.
"He was the winner of the Golden Belt in Taekwondo. They said he rid the military of homosexuals.
Gone was the playful light in Dr. Song's eyes. Comrade Byuk looked away. The driver removed a comb and a pack of cigarettes from his pockets, passed the suit jacket to Jun Do, and began unbuttoning his pants.
Enough of Commander Ga's exploits, Dr. Song said.
Yes, said Comrade Byuk. Let's see how that jacket fits.
Jun Do slid into the jacket. He had no way of knowing if it fit or not. The driver, in his underwear, handed over his pants, and then the last item, a silk tie. Jun Do studied it, running his eyes along the fat and skinny ends.
Look,
the driver said, lighting a cigarette and breathing out smoke.
He doesn't even know how to tie it.
Dr. Song took the tie.
Come, I will show you the nuances of Western neckwear, he said,
then asked Comrade Byuk,
should we employ the Windsor knot or the half Windsor?
Foursquare, Byuk said.
That's what the young men are wearing now.
Together, they ushered Jun Do up the stairs. From the top step, Comrade Byuk turned to the driver.
File a requisition form with your regional allocations clerk, he said.
That'll put you in line for a new suit.
Jun Do looked back to his old clothes on the ground, soon to be scattered among ostrich warrens by the jet wash. Inside the cabin, gold-framed portraits of the dear leader and great leader were paired on the bulkheads. The plane smelled of cigarettes and dirty dishes. Jun Do could tell that dogs had been aboard. He scanned the rows and rows of empty seats but saw no sign of animals. Up front sat a lone man in a black suit and high-brimmed military hat. He was being attended by a stewardess of perfect complexion. Toward the rear of the plane, a half-dozen young men were engrossed in paperwork. One of them employed a computer that folded open and closed. Thrown across a few seats, Jun Do spotted a yellow emergency life raft with a red inflation handle and instructions in Russian. Jun Do placed his hand on it. The sea, the sun, a tin of meat. So many days upon the water. Comrade Byuk approached.
Afraid of flying? He asked.
I don't know, Jun Do said.
The engines began to ramp, and the plane wandered toward the far end of the runway.
I'm in charge of procurement, Comrade Byuk said. This plane's taken me all over the world. To Minsk for fresh caviar, to France for brandy straight from the caves. So don't worry about it going down.
What am I doing here? Jun Do asked.
Come, Comrade Byuk said. Dr. Song wants you to meet the minister.
Jun Do nodded, and they approached the front of the plane, where Dr. Song was speaking to the minister.
Refer to him only as minister,
Comrade Byuk whispered.
And never speak to him directly, only through Dr. Song.
Minister, Dr. Song said. Here is Bak Jun Do, a bona fide hero of the Democratic People's Republic, no?
The minister shook his head dismissively. His face was stippled with gray whiskers, and hanging clumps of brow obscured his eyes.
Certainly, minister, Dr. Song continued. You can tell the boy is strong and handsome, yes?
The minister conceded this with a nod. Dr. Song said,
we will all spend more time together soon, perhaps.
The minister shrugged and gave a look that said maybe, maybe not. That was the extent of their discussion. Walking away, Jun Do asked, what's he a minister of?
Petroleum and tire pressure, Dr. Song said and laughed. He's my driver. But don't worry. That man's seen just about all there is to see in this world. He's strong. His only job is to say nothing on this trip and to enact the yes, no, and perhaps at the end of my questions. You caught that, yes? The way I guided his response. This will keep the Americans occupied while we work our magic.
Americans? Jun Do asked.
Didn't those drivers tell you anything?
Dr. Song asked. The plane pivoted at the end of the runway and began to accelerate. Jun Do braced himself in the aisle.
Comrade Byuk said, I do not think our hero has flown before.
Is this true? Have you not flown?
Dr. Song asked.
We must get you a seat then. We're about to take wing.
With Mandarin formality, Dr. Song ushered them into seats.
Here is the safety belt, he said to Jun Do. A hero may wear one or not, as he wishes. I am old and have no need for safety. But Comrade Byuk, you must apply the belt. You are young. You have a wife and children.
Only because of your great concern, Comrade Byuk said, and fastened the belt. The Ilyushin rose into the western wind, then banked north so that the coast was to starboard. Jun Do could see the shadow of the plane shuddering on the water and beyond the blue expanse of the sea. He did not see the water upon which he fished the seasons with the captain of the Junma, but instead the currents that took him on missions to Japan, every one of them a struggle. The worst part was always the long trip back, listening to the abductees down in the hold, yelling, banging around as they struggled to get free of their ropes. He looked around the cabin, imagined a kidnap victim strapped into one of these seats. He imagined dragging away an American, then spending 16 hours with him inside this plane.
I think you've got the wrong man for your job,
Jun Do volunteered.
My file perhaps suggests I'm an expert kidnapper, and it's true. I led a lot of missions, and only a couple of the targets died on my watch. But I'm not that man anymore. These hands, they tune radio dials now. They no longer know how to do what you want them to do. So forthright and earnest, Dr. Song said. Don't you think, Comrade Byuk?
Comrade Byuk said, You chose well, Dr. Song. The Americans will swoon for such sincerity. Dr. Song turned to Jun Do.
Young man, he said, on this mission, it is your words, not your fists, that you will employ.
Comrade Byuk said, Dr. Song is headed to Texas to lay some groundwork for future talks.
These are the talks before the talks, Dr. Song said. Nothing formal. No delegation, no pictures, no security men. We are merely opening a channel.
Talks about what? Jun Do asked.
The subject doesn't matter, Dr. Song said. Only the posture. The Yankees want a few things from us. We want things as well. High among them is that they halt the boarding of our fishing vessels. You know we use fishing boats for many important tasks. When the moment is right, you will tell the story of your friend being thrown to the sharks by the U.S. Navy. The Americans are very civil. A story like that will have an impact on them, especially the wives.
The stewardess brought Dr. Song a glass of juice and ignored Jun Do and Comrade Byuk.
She is a beauty, yes?
Dr. Song asked.
They comb the entire nation to find them. Young men, all you care about is pleasure. I know. I know. You can't lie to me. I bet you're salivating to meet a CIA agent. Well, I can assure you they don't all look like the beautiful seductresses in the movies.
I've never seen a movie, Jun Do said.
You've never seen a movie?
Dr. Song asked. Not a whole one, Jun Do said.
Oh, you'll have those American ladies eating out of your hand. Wait till they see that wound, Jun Do. Wait till they hear your story.
But my story, Jun Do said, it's so improbable. I hardly believe it myself. To Comrade Byuk, Dr. Song said,
Please, my friend, will you bring us the tiger?
When Byuk was gone, Dr. Song turned to Jun Do.
Where we are from, he said, stories are factual. If a farmer is declared a music virtuoso by the state, everyone had better start calling him maestro. And secretly, he'd be wise to start practicing the piano. For us, the story is more important than the person. If a man and his story are in conflict, it is the man who must change.
Here, Dr. Song took a sip of juice, and the finger he lifted trembled slightly.
But in America, people's stories change all the time. In America, it is the man who matters.
Perhaps they will believe your story and perhaps not. But you, Jun-do, they will believe you.
Dr. Song called the stewardess over.
This man is a hero of the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, and he must have juice.
After she raced to get it, he said,
See?
Shaking his head, he said,
But you try explaining all this to the central bunker.
Here, Dr. Song pointed downward, and Jun-do knew he was indicating the dear leader, Kim Jong-il himself. Comrade Byuk returned with an ice chest. This he handed to Jun-do.
The tiger, he said.
Inside was a slab of meat wrapped in a dirty plastic bag. Sprigs of grass clung to the meat, which was warm to the touch. Jun-do said,
Perhaps some ice would be called for.
Dr. Song smiled.
Oh, he said. The Americans, I can see their faces now.
Tiger! Imagine their response.
Comrade Byuk was laughing.
I would love to, he said in English. But I had tiger for lunch.
Looks delicious,
Dr. Song said.
Too bad I'm on a leopard-only diet.
Comrade Byuk said, Wait till the minister gets in on the act.
The minister would like to cook it personally, yes?
Dr. Song said.
The minister insists all the Americans must partake, yes?
Jun-do looked at the cooler, which bore a red cross. He'd seen a cooler like it before. It was the kind they used to get the blood to Pyongyang.
Two things about the Americans,
Dr. Song said.
First, their minds are fast, and they puzzle over everything. You must give them a riddle to redirect those minds. So we offer them the minister. Second, they must have moral superiority. They don't know how to negotiate without it. Always their talks open with human rights, personal freedoms, and so on. But the tiger changes all that. Their horror at the notion that we would casually eat an endangered species will immediately put them on high ground. Then we can get down to business.
In English, Comrade Byuk said, Here, Senator, let me pass you the platter.
Yes, Senator,
Dr. Song said.
You must have seconds.
They laughed until they saw Jun-do's face.
You do understand,
Dr. Song said,
that in this cooler is only cow flank. The tiger part is only a story. That's what we're really serving them, a story.
But what if they eat it? Jun-do asked. If they believe it is tiger, yet out of a wish not to offend, they eat it and feel morally degraded, won't they take it out on you in the talks? Comrade Byuk turned in anticipation of Dr. Song's response.
If the Americans use their senses and keep their heads level,
Dr. Song said,
then no tiger story will fool them. They will taste that this is cow. But if the Americans are just toying with us, if they don't plan on seeking the facts and negotiating seriously, then they will taste tiger.
You think if they believe the tiger story, Jun-do said, then they'll believe my story.
Yours will certainly be the tougher meat to chew, he said.
One of the young men on Comrade Byuk's procurement team came forward with three identical watches. Comrade Byuk took them.
One for the minister,
he said, and handed the others to Dr. Song and Jun-do. They're set to Texas time. Everybody gets the same one. It sends a message to the Americans about Korean equality and solidarity. What about you? Jun-do asked. Where's your watch? Comrade Byuk said, Oh, I've got no business in Texas.
Sadly, Comrade Byuk won't be joining us,
Dr. Song said.
He has another mission.
Comrade Byuk stood.
Yes, I should go prepare my team.
The stewardess passed by with hot towels and handed one to Dr. Song.
What do I have to do?
Comrade Byuk said after she'd left.
She cannot help it, Dr. Song said. Women naturally respond to the allure of an older gentleman. It is a fact that only an older man can truly please a woman.
Comrade Byuk laughed.
I thought you always said only a small-statured man can please a woman.
Dr. Song defended himself.
I'm hardly small-statured. I have the exact dimensions of the dear leader, even my shoe size.
It's true, Comrade Bjork said. I procure for the dear leader. They are two of a kind. Jundo took a window seat as they flew north over Sakhalin, Kamchatka, and the Sea of Okhotsk, where the captain had been imprisoned somewhere down there in the blue. They outran the sunset by flying north into perpetual summer light. They stopped at the Russian Air Force Base in Anadyr to refuel, and all the old pilots came out to marvel at the sight of an Ilyushin 62, which they concluded was 47 years old. They ran their hands along the belly of the plane and talked about all the problems that were corrected in later versions, and everyone had a hair-raising story about flying them before the remnants of the fleet were shipped to Africa in the late 80s. The tower operator came forward, a large man, and Jundo could see the places he'd once had frostbite. The tower operator said even the Ilyushin's replacements, the early Antonovs and Tupolevs, were rare these days.
I hear the last Ilyushin 62 went down in Angola in the year 1999, he added.
Dr. Song broke into Russian.
It is lamentable, he said, that the once great nation that created this fine aircraft is no longer able to do so.
Comrade Bjork added,
please know that news of your country's complete collapse was met with sadness in our nation.
Yes, Dr. Song said. Your nation and ours were once the world's twin beacons of communism. Sadly, we now bear that burden alone.
Comrade Bjork opened a suitcase of new U.S. $100 bills to pay for the fuel. But the tower operator shook his head no.
Euros, he said.
Indignant, Dr. Song said,
I am personal friends with the mayor of Vladivostok.
Euros, said the tower operator. Comrade Bjork had another suitcase, it turned out, this one filled with European money. As they were departing, Dr. Song told the pilots to make a statement. They rolled the engines hard during takeoff, rattling the airframe in a tremendous display of ascent. The Aleutians, the international dateline, and 9,000 meters up, the crisp outlines of container vessels against a stippled, green-white sea. The captain had told Jundo that off the east coast of Japan, the ocean was 9,000 meters deep, and now he understood what that meant. Witnessing the vastness of the Pacific, how impossibly monumental that you could row across it, he understood how rare his radio contacts had been. Where was the arm of the captain of the Quanli? Jundo suddenly wondered. In whose hands were his old dictionaries right now, and what person shaved this morning with the captain's brush? In what tunnel was his team now running? And what had become of the old woman they'd kidnapped, the one who said she would go willingly if she could take his picture? What could the look on his face have been, and what story did the Niigata bartender tell of the night she drank with kidnappers? The second mate's wife suddenly came to him in her canning line jumpsuit, her skin glistening with fish oil, her hair wild from steam, and that rustling yellow dress enveloped him, took him deep into sleep. Somewhere over Canada, Dr. Song gathered everyone for a protocol briefing on the subject of Americans. He spoke to the minister and Jundo, as well as Comrade Bjork's team of six. The co-pilot and stewardess eavesdropped. Dr. Song prefaced everything with a preamble on the evils of capitalism and a recounting of American war crimes against subjugated peoples. Then he began by tackling the concept of Jesus Christ, examining the special case of the American Negro, and listing the reasons Mexicans defected to the United States. Next, he explained why affluent Americans drove their own cars and spoke to their servants as equals. One young man asked how to behave should he encounter a homosexual.
Point out that this is a new experience for you, Dr. Song said. As there are no such individuals where you are from, then treat him as you would any visiting Juche scholar from foreign lands like Burma or Ukraine or Cuba.
Dr. Song then got practical. He said it was okay to wear shoes indoors. Women were free to smoke in America and should not be confronted. Disciplining other people's children in America was not okay. He drew for them on a piece of paper the shape of a football. With great discomfort, Dr. Song touched on American standards of personal hygiene and then he delivered a mini-lecture on the subject of smiling. He concluded with dogs, noting how Americans were very sentimental with a particular softness toward canines. "You must never hurt a dog in America," he said. "They are considered part of the family and are given names just like people. Dogs also have their own beds and toys and doctors and houses, which should not be referred to as warrens." When they finally began their descent, Comrade Byuk sought out Jun Do.
"About Dr. Song," he said. "He's had a long and famous career, but in Pyongyang, you're only as safe as your last success."
"Safe?" Jun Do asked.
"Safe from what?"
Comrade Byuk touched the watch that Jun Do now wore.
"You just help him succeed."
"What about you? Why aren't you coming with us?"
"Me?" Comrade Byuk asked. "I've got 24 hours to get to Los Angeles, buy $300,000 worth of DVDs, and then get back. Is it true you've never seen a movie?"
"I'm not a rube or anything. I just never had the opportunity."
"Now's your chance," Comrade Byuk said. "Dr. Song has requested a movie about Sopranos."
"I'd have no way of playing a DVD," Jun Do told him.
"You'd find a way," Comrade Byuk said.
"What about Sun Moon? I'd see a movie starring her."
"They don't sell our films in America."
"Is it true that she's sad?"
"Sun Moon," Comrade Byuk nodded. "Her husband, Commander Ga, and the dear leader are rivals. Commander Ga is too famous to punish, so it is his wife who gets no more movie roles. We hear her next door. She plays the kayagum all day, teaching that sad, wandering sound to her children."
Jun Do could see her fingers pluck the strings, each note striking, flaring, and losing timbre like a match that burns to smoke.
"Last chance for an American movie," Comrade Byuk said. "They're the only real reason to learn English."
Jun Do tried to gauge the nature of the offer. In Comrade Byuk's eyes, Jun Do saw a look he knew well from childhood, the look of a boy who thought the next day would be better. Those boys never lasted. Still, Jun Do liked them the most.
"Okay," he said. "Which one's the best?"
"Casablanca," Comrade Byuk said. "They say that one is the greatest."
"Casablanca," Jun Do said. "I'll take that one." It was morning when they landed at Dyess Air Force Base, south of Abilene, Texas. Jun Do's nocturnal schedule served him now on the other side of the world. He was awake and alert. Through the Ilyushin's yellowed window, he could see that two older cars had pulled onto the blacktop to meet them. There were three Americans in hats out there, two men and a woman. When the Ilyushin rested its engines, they rolled up a metal stairway.
"In 24 hours,
Dr. Song said as a farewell to Comrade Byuk. Comrade Byuk executed a quick bow and then opened the door. The air was dry. It smelled of hot metal and withered corn stalks. Fighter jets, a row of them, were parked at a shimmering distance. They were things Jun Do had only seen in inspirational murals. At the bottom of the stairs, their three hosts were waiting. Standing in the center was the senator, who was perhaps older than Dr. Song, yet tall and tan in blue pants and an embroidered shirt. Jun Do could see a molded medical device filling the senator's ear. If Dr. Song was 60, the senator must have had a decade on him. Tommy was the senator's friend, a black man, much the same age, though leaner, with hair that had gone white and a face more deeply creased. And then there was Wanda. She was young, thick-bodied, and had a yellow ponytail sticking out the back of a ball cap that read, "Blackwater." She wore a red cowgirl shirt with silver snaps.
"Minister," the senator said.
"Senator,"
the minister said, and there were general greetings all around.
"Come," the senator said. "We've got a little side trip planned."
The senator directed the minister toward an old American car. When the minister moved to open the driver's side door, The senator gently directed him to the other side. Tommy indicated a white convertible whose chrome lettering proclaimed Mustang.
I must travel with them,
Dr. Song said. They're in a Thunderbird, Wanda said. It only seats two.
But they don't speak the same language,
Dr. Song said. Tommy said,
Half of Texas don't speak the same language.
The Mustang, top down, followed the Thunderbird out onto a county road. Jun Do rode in the back seat with Dr. Song. Tommy drove. Wanda lifted her head into the wind, moving her face back and forth, enjoying it. Far ahead and far behind, Jun Do could make out the black of security vehicles. The side of the road glimmered with broken glass. Why would a country be strewn with razor-sharp glass? To Jun Do, it seemed like some tragedy had taken place every step of the way. And where were all the people? A barbed wire fence paced them, making it feel as if they were in a normal control permit zone. But rather than concrete poles with insulators for the electricity, the posts were made from gnarled, bleached branches that looked like broken limbs or old bones, as if something had died to build every 5 meters of that fence.
This is quite a special car, Dr. Song said.
It's the senator's, Tommy said. We've been friends since our army days.
Tommy's arm was hanging outside the car in the wind. He slapped the metal twice.
I had known war and Vietnam, he said, and I had known Jesus. But it wasn't until I borrowed this Mustang with rolled and tucked back seats that I knew Mary McParsons and took my first breath as a man.
Wanda laughed. Dr. Song shifted uncomfortably on the leather. Jun Do could see on the face of Dr. Song the great insult that had been done him to be informed he was sitting where Tommy had once had intercourse.
Oh, Tommy went on. I cringe when I think of the guy I used to be. Thank God I ain't still him.
I married that woman, by the way.
I did that right, rest her soul.
Dr. Song observed a political sign bearing the image of the senator and an American flag.
There is an election coming, no?
He asked.
That's right, Tommy said. The senator's got a primary in August.
We are lucky, Jun Do,
Dr. Song said,
to witness American democracy in action.
Jun Do tried to think of how Comrade Byuk would respond. Most exciting, Jun Do said. Dr. Song asked,
Will the senator retain his representative position?
It's pretty much a sure thing, Tommy said.
A sure thing?
Dr. Song asked.
That doesn't sound very democratic.
Jun Do said, That's not how we were taught democracy works.
Tell me,
Dr. Song said to Tommy,
What will be the voter turnout?
Tommy looked at them in the rearview mirror.
Of registered voters? For a primary, that would be about 40%.
40%?
Dr. Song exclaimed.
Voter turnout in the Democratic People's Republic of Korea is 99%, the most democratic nation in the world. Still, the United States needn't feel shame. Your country can still be a beacon for countries with lower turnouts like Burundi, Paraguay, and Chechnya.
99% turnout. With democracy like that, I'm sure you'll soon be over 100.
Wanda laughed, caught Jun Do's eye and offered him a smile that was sly-eyed, seeming to include him in the humor. Tommy looked at them in the rearview mirror.
You don't actually believe that most democratic nation business, do you? You know the truth about where you're from, right?
Wanda said,
Don't ask them questions like that. The wrong answer could get them in trouble back home.
Tommy said, Tell me you at least know the South won the war. Please know that much.
But you're wrong, my dear Thomas,
Dr. Song said.
I believe it was the Confederacy that lost the war. It was the North that prevailed.
Wanda smiled at Tommy.
He got you on that one, she said.
Tommy laughed.
He sure did.
They pulled off the road at a cowboy emporium. The parking lot was empty, save for the Thunderbird and a black car parked to the side. Inside, several salespersons were waiting to outfit the visitors in Western attire. Dr. Song translated to the minister that cowboy boots were gifts from the senator, and he could have any pair he wished. The minister was fascinated by the exotic boots and tried on pairs made from lizard, ostrich, and shark. Finally, he decided on snake, and the staff began seeking out pairs in his size. Dr. Song conferred briefly with the minister, then announced,
"The minister must make a defecate."
The Americans clearly wished to laugh, but didn't dare. The minister was gone a long time. John Doe found a pair of black boots that spoke to him, but in the end he set them aside. He then went through many pairs of women's boots before he found some he thought would fit the second mate's wife. They were yellow and stiff, with fancy stitching around the toe. Dr. Song was offered smaller and smaller sizes, until finally a pair of simple black boots fit him in a boy's size. To help save face, John Doe turned to Dr. Song.
"Is it true," he said loudly, "that you take the exact shoe size as the dear leader Kim Jong-il?"
Everyone watched as Dr. Song took a pleasant stroll in his boots, dress shoes in his hands. He stopped before a mannequin in cowboy clothes.
"Observe, John Doe," he said. "Instead of their most beautiful women, the Americans employ artificial people to display the clothes."
"Most ingenious," John Doe said. "Perhaps," Wanda said, "our most beautiful women are otherwise engaged." Dr. Song bowed at the truth of this.
"Of course," he said. "How short-sighted of me."
On the wall, mounted behind a piece of glass, was an axe.
"Look," Dr. Song said. "The Americans are always prepared for a sudden outbreak of violence."
The senator glanced at his watch, and John Doe could tell he'd had enough of this game. The minister returned and was handed a pair of boots. Each scale of the snakeskin seemed to catch the light. Clearly pleased, the minister took a few steps in them like a gunslinger.
"Have you seen this movie, High Noon?" Dr. Song asked them. "It is the minister's favorite."
And suddenly the senator was smiling again. Dr. Song spoke to the minister.
"They fit perfectly, no?"
he asked. The minister looked sadly down at his new boots. He shook his head. The senator snapped his fingers.
"Let's get some more boots over here,"
he told the sales clerks.
"I'm sorry," Dr. Song said.
He sat to remove his own boots.
"But the minister believes it would be an insult to the dear leader to receive the gift of new boots when the dear leader himself received none."
John Doe returned the boots he'd chosen for the second mate's wife. It was a fantasy idea, anyway, he knew. The minister, too, sat to pull off his boots.
"This can be easily fixed," the senator said. "Of course we can send a pair of boots to Mr. Kim. We know he takes the same size as Dr. Song here.
We'll just get an extra pair."
Dr. Song laced his dress shoes back on.
"The only insult," Dr. Song said, "would be for a humble diplomat such as myself to wear shoes fit for the most revered leader of the greatest nation on earth."
Wanda's eyes passed back and forth upon this scene. Her gaze landed on John Doe, and he knew it was him that she was puzzling over. They left, without boots. The ranch had been prepared to give the Koreans a taste of Texas life. They crossed a cattle grate to enter the property, then switched to pickup trucks. Again, the senator traveled with the minister, while the rest of the group followed in a four-door work truck. They took a road of sand and shale, and they passed through wind-bent bushes and gnarled trees that looked burned and split, with even their tall branches twisted to the ground. There was a field of spiked plants, their sharp claws aglow. Each was alone in the way it groped from the rocky earth, looking to John Doe like gestures from those buried underneath. During the ride to the ranch, the Americans seemed to ignore the Koreans, making comments about cattle that John Doe could find no sign of, and then slipping into a shorthand of their own that John Doe could make no sense of. "Blackwater," Tommy said to Wanda. "They your new outfit?" They were heading toward a stand of trees from which blew white, vinylon-like fibers.
"Blackwater?
That's what your hat says."
"It's just a free hat," she said.
"Right now I think I'm working for a civilian subsidiary of a government contractor to the military. No use trying to keep it straight. I've got 3 homeland passes, and I've never set foot in the place."
"Headed back to Baghdad?" he asked.
She looked across the Texas hardpan. Friday, she said. The sun was direct when they climbed down from the big truck. Jundo's dress shoes filled with sand. A table had been set up with a barrel cooler of lemonade and three gift baskets, each wrapped in cellophane. The baskets contained a cowboy hat, a pint of bourbon, a carton of American Spirit cigarettes, some beef jerky, a water bottle, sunscreen, a red kerchief, and a pair of calfskin gloves. "My wife's doing," the senator said. The senator invited them to retrieve the hats and gloves from their gift baskets. A motorized saw and weed cutter had been set out, and the Koreans donned safety goggles to cut brush. Dr. Song's eyes, through the plastic, were seething with indignity. Tommy pull-started the weed cutter and handed it to the minister, who seemed to take a strange pleasure in moving the blade back and forth through the dead brambles. When it was Dr. Song's turn, he said, "It seems I, too, have the pleasure." He positioned his goggles, then raced the engine through brush and stubble, before stalling the blade in the sand.
"I fear I have little aptitude for groundskeeping," Dr. Song said to the senator. "But, as the great leader Kim Il-sung prescribes, ask not what the Democratic People's Republic of Korea can do for you. Ask what you can do for the Democratic People's Republic of Korea."
The senator sucked air through his teeth. Tommy said, "Isn't he also the great leader who regretted that his citizens had one life to give for their country?" "Okay," the senator said. "Let's try our hand at fishing." Poles had been laid out at a stock pond fed by well pumps. The sun was relentless, and in his dark suit, Dr. Song looked unsteady. The senator took two folding chairs from the bed of his truck, and he and Dr. Song sat in the shade of a tree. Though he fanned himself with the hat as the senator did, Dr. Song did not loosen his tie. Tommy spoke low and respectfully to the minister. Jundo translated. "Cast beyond the trunk of that fallen tree," Tommy suggested. "Jiggle the tip of the pole to make your lure dance as you reel in." Wanda approached Jundo with two glasses of lemonade.
"I have once been fishing with cables of electricity," the minister said. "Very effective."
It was the first time the minister had spoken all day. Jundo could think of no way to soften this statement. Finally, he translated it to Tommy as,
"The minister believes victory is at hand."
Jundo took the lemonade from Wanda, who had an eyebrow raised in suspicion. It let Jundo know that she was no clear-complexioned stewardess offering drinks to powerful men. It took the minister a few casts to get the knack of it, Tommy pantomiming advice. "Here," she said to Jundo. "Here's my contribution to your gift basket." She handed him a tiny LED flashlight. "They give them away at the trade shows," she said. "I use them all the time."
"You work in the dark?" he asked.
"Bunkers," she said. "That's my specialty. I analyze fortified bunkers." "I'm Wanda, by the way. I didn't get to introduce myself."
"Park Jundo," he said, taking her hand. "How do you know the senator?"
"He visited Baghdad, and I gave him a tour of Saddam's Saladin complex, a very impressive structure. High-speed rail tunnels, triple-filtered air, nuke-resistant.
Once you see someone's bunker, you know everything about him.
You get news of the war?"
"Constantly," Jundo told her.
He clicked the light on and cupped his hand over the beam to measure its brightness.
"The Americans use lights in tunnel combat?"
"How could you not use lights?" she asked.
"Doesn't your army have goggles that see in the dark?"
"Honestly," she said, "I don't think Americans have done that kind of fighting since Vietnam. My uncle was one of them, a tunnel rat. These days, if there was a situation underground, they'd send a bot."
"A bot?"
"You know, a robot, remote-controlled," she said. "They've got some beauties."
"Minister,"
Dr. Song said more softly. The minister's pole bent as a fish ran with the lure. The minister kicked his shoes off and stepped ankle-deep into the water. It put up a tremendous struggle, the pole moving this way and that, and Jundo thought, there must be a more placid variety of fish to stock a pond with. The minister's shirt was soaked with sweat when he finally reeled the fish close. Tommy landed it, a fat white thing. Tommy removed the hook and then held it high for everyone to see, a finger in its gaping mouth to demonstrate the jaws. Then Tommy released the fish back into the pond.
My fish!
The minister shouted. He took a step forward in anger.
Minister!
Dr. Song called and rushed over. He placed his hands on the minister's shoulders, which were rising and falling.
Minister!
Dr. Song said more softly.
Why don't we move right along to target practice? The senator suggested.
They walked a short pace through the desert. Dr. Song had a difficult time taking the uneven terrain in his dress shoes, though he would accept no help. The minister spoke, and Jun Do translated.
The minister has heard that Texas is home to a most poisonous snake. He desires to shoot one, so that he might see if it is more powerful than our country's dreaded rock mamushi.
In the middle of the day, the senator said, rattlesnakes are down in their holes, where it's cool. In the morning, that's when they're out and about.
Jun Do relayed this to the minister, who said,
tell the American senator to have his black helper pour water down the snake's hole, and I will shoot the specimen when it emerges.
Hearing the answer, the senator smiled, shook his head.
The problem is, the rattlesnake's protected.
Jun Do translated, yet the minister was confused.
Protected from what?
He wanted to know.
Jun Do asked the senator, from what is the snake protected?
From the people? The senator said.
The law protects them.
This was found most humorous by the minister, that a vicious man-killing snake would be protected from its victims. They came to a shooting bench with several Wild West revolvers lined up. Various cans had been placed at a distance as a shooting gallery. The .45 caliber revolvers were heavy and worn, and the senator assured them had all revoked the lives of men. His great-grandfather had been a sheriff in this county, and these pistols had been taken as evidence in murder cases. Dr. Song declined to shoot.
I do not trust my hands, he said, and sat in the shade.
The senator said that his shooting days were behind him, too. Tommy began loading the weapons.
We got plenty of pistols, he told Wanda. You going to give us a demonstration?
She was refastening her ponytail.
Who, me?
She asked.
I don't think so.
The senator would be mad if I embarrassed our guests. The minister, however, was in his element. He set about wielding the pistols as if he'd spent his days smoking and conversing and firing at things propped in the distance by his servants, rather than parked at a curb reading the daily Rodong Shinmun, waiting for his boss, Dr. Song, to finish with his meetings.
Korea,
Dr. Song said,
is a land of mountains. Gunshots bring swift responses from the canyon walls. Here, the bang goes off into the distance, never to return.
Jun Do agreed. It was a truly lonesome thing to have such a commotion be swallowed by the landscape, to have the sound of fire make no echo. The minister was surprisingly accurate, and soon he was feigning quick draws and attempting trick shots as Tommy reloaded for him. They all watched the minister go through boxes of ammo, firing with two hands, a cigarette in his lips, the cans popping and leaping. Today, he was the minister. People drove him around. He pulled the trigger. The minister turned to them. He addressed them in English.
The good,
he said, blowing smoke from the barrel.
The bad and the ugly.
The ranch house was single level and half hidden by trees, deceptively sprawling. A nearby corral contained picnic tables and a chuck wagon grill, where several people were lined up for lunch. The cicadas were active, and Jun Do could smell the cooking coals. A midday breeze stirred, heading for anvil clouds too distant to promise rain. Free-roaming dogs leaped in and out of the corral's fencing. At one point, the dogs noticed something moving in a distant bush. They stood at attention, bristling. Walking past, the senator said,
hunt!
And at the command, the dogs raced off to flush a group of small birds that ran quickly through the brush. When the dogs returned, the senator gave them treats from his pocket, And John Doe understood that in communism, you'd threaten a dog into compliance, while in capitalism, obedience is obtained through bribes. The food line favored no rank or privilege. Standing together were the senator, the ranch hands, the house servants, the security agents in their black suits, the wives of Texas officials. While the minister took a seat at a picnic table and was brought his food by the senator's wife, Dr. Song and John Doe lined up with plates made from paper. The young man next to John Doe and Dr. Song introduced himself as a PhD candidate from the university. He was writing a dissertation on the North Korean nuclear program. He leaned in close and said quietly,
"You know the South won the war, right?"
They were served beef ribs, corn grilled in the husk, marinated tomatoes, and a scoop of macaroni. Dr. Song and John Doe made their way to where the minister ate with the senator and his wife. Dogs followed them. Dr. Song sat with them.
"Please join us," he said to John Doe. "There is plenty of room, no?"
"I'm sorry," John Doe told them. "I'm sure you have important matters to discuss."
He sat alone at a wooden picnic table that had been vandalized with people's initials. The meat was both sweet and spicy, the tomatoes tangy, but the corn and noodles were made most foul by butter and cheese, substances he knew only from dialogues they'd heard recited over tapes in his language school. "I would like to buy some cheese. Please pass the butter." A large bird circled above. He didn't know its variety. Wanda joined him. She was licking a white plastic spoon.
"Jesus," she said. "Don't miss out on the pecan pie."
He had just finished eating a rib and his hands were covered with sauce. She nodded to the end of the table, where a dog sat patiently, staring. Its eyes were cloudy blue and its coat was marbled gray and brindle. How could a dog, obviously well-fed, capture the exact look of an orphan boy, relegated to the end of the line?
"Go ahead,"
Wanda said.
"Why not?"
He threw the bone, which was snapped from the air.
"That's a Catahoula dog," she said. "A gift from the governor of Louisiana for helping out after the hurricane."
John Doe lifted another rib. He couldn't stop eating them, even when it felt as if the meat was backing up in his throat.
"Who are all these people?" he asked.
Wanda looked around.
"A couple think tankers, some NGO folk, various looky-loos. The North Koreans don't visit every day, you know."
"What about you?"
he asked.
"Are you a think tanker or a looky-loo?"
"I'm the shadowy intelligence figure," she said.
John Doe stared at her. She smiled.
"Come on. Do I look shadowy?"
she asked.
"I'm an open source gal. I'm all about sharing. You can ask me anything you want."
Tommy crossed the corral holding a cup of iced tea, coming from wherever he'd stored the poles and pistols. John Doe watched Tommy line up and get served, offering a bow of the head when he was handed his plate. John Doe said to Wanda,
"You're looking at me like maybe I never saw a black person before."
Wanda shrugged.
"It's possible."
"I met the U.S. Navy before," John Doe said. "Lots of those guys are black. And my English teacher was from Angola. The only black man in the DPRK. He said it wasn't so lonely as long as he gave us all African accents."
Wanda said,
"I heard a story that in the 70s, an American soldier crossed the DMZ, a boy from North Carolina who was drunk or something. The North Koreans made him a language teacher, but had to stop after he taught all the agents to talk like crackers."
John Doe didn't know what she meant by cracker.
"I never heard that story," he said. "And I'm not an agent, if that's what you're suggesting."
Wanda watched him dig into another rib.
"I'm surprised you didn't take me up on my offer to answer any question," she said. "I'd have bet you'd ask me if I spoke Korean."
"Do you?"
he asked.
"But I can tell when someone's muddling a translation. That's why I figure you're here, as something other than a lowly interpreter."
Dr. Song and the minister stood at their picnic table. Dr. Song announced,
"The minister wishes to present gifts to the senator and his wife. For the senator, the selected works of Kim Jong-il."
Here, Dr. Song produced the bound 11-volume set. A Mexican woman walked by with a tray full of food.
Ibe,
she said to Wanda.
Oh, Pilar,
Wanda called after her.
You're bad.
The senator accepted the gift with a smile.
Are they signed?
He asked. Dr. Song's face showed a flash of uncertainty. He conferred with the minister. Jundo couldn't hear them, but their words were flashing back and forth. Then Dr. Song smiled.
The dear leader, Kim Jong-il, would be happy to inscribe the books in person should the senator visit as our guest in Pyongyang.
In return, the senator gave the minister an iPod loaded with country music. Dr. Song then began to speak publicly of the beauty and graciousness of the senator's wife, while the minister prepared to offer her the cooler. The smell of that meat returned to Jundo's nose. He set the rib aside and looked away.
What?
Wanda asked him.
What's in that cooler?
This seemed like a turning point somehow, that Dr. Song's ruses up till now were all in fun. But the tiger ploy was of a different sort. One sniff and the Americans would know that the meat was foul, that some ugly game was being played, and everything would be different. I need to know, Jundo asked her.
Were you serious?
Of course, she said. Serious about what?
He took her hand. With a pen, he wrote across her palm the name of the second mate.
I need to know if he made it, Jundo said. Did he get out?
Using her phone, Wanda took a picture of her hand. She typed a message using both her thumbs and then pressed send.
Let's find out, she said.
Dr. Song finished his tribute to the loveliness of the senator's wife, and the minister handed her the cooler.
From the citizens of the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, he said. Fresh tiger meat, taken recently from a majestic beast culled from the peaks of Mount Baekdu. You can't imagine how white was his fur. The minister desires that we all feast of it tonight, yes?
The minister nodded with pride. Dr. Song adopted a wily smile.
And remember,
he said to the senator's wife,
when you eat of the tiger, you become like the tiger.
People stopped eating to witness the senator's wife's reaction to this, but she said nothing. The clouds were thicker now, and the air smelled of rain that probably wouldn't arrive. The senator removed the cooler from the table. Let me see if I can take charge of that, he said with a businesslike smile.
Tiger sounds like a man's business.
The senator's wife turned her attention to a dog at her side. She cupped its ears with both hands and spoke sweetly to it. The gift ceremony seemed to have slipped from Dr. Song's hands. He was at a loss as to what had gone wrong. He came over to Jundo.
How are you holding up, son?
He asked.
It's the arm. It's hurting quite badly, I can tell. Yes?
Jundo rotated his shoulder a couple of times. Yes, but I'll be okay, Dr. Song. I'll manage. Dr. Song looked frantic.
No need, son. I knew this time would come. There's no bravery lost in seeking medical attention.
He looked to Wanda.
You wouldn't have a knife or some scissors we could use.
Wanda looked to Jundo.
Is your arm hurt?
She asked. When he nodded, Wanda called the senator's wife over, and for the first time, Jundo took true notice of her. A lean woman with shoulder-length white hair and pale, pearled eyes.
I think our friend here is hurt, Wanda told her.
To the senator's wife, Dr. Song asked,
Is it possible to get some alcohol and a knife? It's no emergency. We simply have some stitches to remove.
Are you a doctor, doctor?
The senator's wife asked.
No,
Dr. Song said. She turned to Jundo.
Where are you hurt?
She asked him.
I used to practice medicine.
It's nothing,
Dr. Song said.
We probably should have removed the stitches before we left.
She turned to Dr. Song, glaring. Her lack of patience for him blazed until he looked away. She brought out a pair of glasses and placed them on the end of her nose.
Show me,
she said to Jundo. He removed his suit coat and then his shirt. He offered his arm for the senator's wife to examine. She lifted her head to employ the lenses. The eyelets of the sutures were red and inflamed. When she pressed her thumb, they wept.
Yes, she said. These must come out. Come, I have a good light in the kitchen.
Soon the senator's wife and Wanda had him shirtless, sitting on the kitchen counter. The kitchen was bright yellow, the walls painted.